This week, we give it 3 snaps up. Welcome to the Midwest Peace Process.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I have the pleasure to present to you now. Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I have the pleasure to present to you.
The Midwest Peace Process.
The world is very different now.
The Midwest Peace
To remind
Process.
America of the fierce urgency of now. 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 Now.
Welcome to episode 83. Today is May 8th, 2015. I'm Jerry.
I'm Jeremy.
And this is Rob.
The summer blockbuster season is upon us once again. So this episode, we are at the movies. And like I recently tweeted, it's like Siskel and Ebert and another guy who knows nothing about movies.
That's right. Probably dating yourself with a Siskel, too.
Yeah, true. Speaking of tweets, are you following us on social media?
I'm not.
We are a freaking media empire over here. Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, we got them all. You can listen to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and of course our website, MidwestPeaceProcess.com. We love to hear from our listeners, so email us your thoughts about this or any episode to feedback@MidwestPeaceProcess.com. And once again, our break music is provided by the Polish ambassador.
Yep.
What is Stitcher?
Oh, man. Stitcher is an app that lets you subscribe to podcasts. A lot like iTunes.
But, thank you for that.
But outside the Apple ecosystem.
Oh,
so,
thank goodness.
So better, right?
Better.
So like I said, we are at the movies this episode, and we are discussing our favorite political-themed films, or in Rob's case, a movie he had never seen before.
Just like last time.
Good Lord.
It's a theme.
So we each picked a movie, and then we each watched all 3 movies, and now we're going to share our thoughts about each one. So, you know, spoiler alert, we're going to talk about these. If you haven't seen them, and you want to see them,
you're perfectly qualified to pick one, then.
Press pause now and go watch the movie and then come back. And so we're going to kick things off with Rob's movie, which was Doctor Strangelove, or it's the alternate title, Rob.
Or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb.
There you go.
The alternate title.
Once again, the conservatives supplied the information to the liberal.
The conservative bought a booklet. He participated in commerce.
So, Rob, your thoughts on Dr. Strangelove. So Would you like to introduce the movie for our listeners
sure,
who haven't
okay.
seen
we'll
it?
We'll give a little plot summary here. So, Dr. Strangelove was, came out in 1964, a black and white film. That I completely forgot was edited by my man Stanley Kubrick. I don't know how I forgot that, but
yeah, once,
it was like a little surprise to me. So this is a movie I heard a lot about. You always hear it as kind of something referencing satire and politics.
It's a classic, right?
What's that?
Yeah. It's a classic.
It is a classic.
And I think it's in the Library of Congress's top 100 most influential movies or something
yeah,
like
it's
that.
Made a bunch
and
of
also the, used in war planning from what I've come to understand.
And yeah, it's in the all the little AFI top 100 lists and that whole thing. So yeah, it's got Peter Sellers plays 3 roles in it, which I completely didn't know he played the president. I was like, whoever's playing that president is fantastic. But he's always shot from a long distance. I didn't realize it was him.
Merkin Mifflin.
I'm fine too.
That's right. And so
his character's name is Merkin Muffley.
Yes.
Everybody knows what a Merkin is, right?
President Merkin Muffley. I'll be honest here, I had to look it up.
I looked it up.
I did too.
Oh,
and
yes.
And for those who don't know, a Merkin is a pubic wig.
So just let that for a while. So I guess the plot summary, it involves a kind of a rogue, I guess, general maybe in Alaska or something that starts worrying about the influence of the Russians, and so starts basically launches his own Plan R, as it's known, which is essentially a plan to get all the B-52s in the SAC command, the Strategic Air Command, to launch the all-out attack on Russian nuclear forces.
First strike.
And then so the plan becomes, how do we stop this attack that's already in place? So that's what the movie's all about, or is it? So I got some questions to pose to you guys, see what you think. I mean, in the first place, like why do you think it was filmed in black and white? Was there a particular thing that did for the movie, or, you know, did it? I mean, I thought it looked fantastic, but I don't really.
I don't know. I think all good movies are actually filmed in black and white. That's a stipulation that for it to become a cult classic or anything.
And it is kind of funny to watch black and white movies, you know, that have probably been remastered or whatever on the modern technology. You have these kind of like high def TVs. Like I always equate black and white from when we were kids and we would watch the black and white movie on the cathode ray tube. It's all blurry. Like now some of those shots, you know, yeah, Kubrick, my man, he's always good with the lighting. You know, and stuff's real crisp and cool. Anyway, I had a thought about that. But there's some really good.
So I think maybe black and white was chosen to give it that feel of being retro in some way, you know?
Yeah.
Or timeless, or
I think there are a lot of things in the movie that dated, you know.
Sure.
And not just in the way you would normally, you know, date a film, like the wardrobe or
right.
You know, cell phones. You know, the typical stuff you see in a movie that kind of dates it. I mean, this one really does seem like it was put in a time capsule, and we're watching something from way back, you know, and
like
I don't
way
know
back 1964 back, or you think this is a like, story about humanity,
like even farther maybe, like just because of the references, all the Nazi kind of or anti-Nazi sentiment that's in the movie, you know, it seems like part of that would have made sense to somebody alive in 1964 who had perhaps lived through World War II.
Oh, you think it was harkening back to...
All of that would have more significance for that audience than it does for us today.
So that's a decent reason. So if you were my age, you can do some math here. If you were my age and watching it come out in 1964, then you would have, just finished up World War I and going through World War II. So you think it was meant to harken back to the Nazi era then?
Yeah.
Okay. Because it kind of brings me to my next question is like why is it even called Dr. Strangelove? Out of all the characters, all the themes, all the things that's going on. Like, I mean, to me, I don't think I completely got why he was such a why the Strangelove character was such a seminal character in the movie. I mean, maybe that's why it's got an alternate title, or maybe it's just his name is awesome. But it's based off a book that whose original name was Red Alert,
right?
Which makes more sense. I mean, why do you think they called it Dr. Strangelove of all things? Marketing thing, or
so? I mean, the things I read about it was that, you know, Kubrick read the book Red Alert,
okay,
liked it, immediately bought the movie rights. And it wasn't until he started doing a treatment of a screenplay for it that he realized that he couldn't really do the kind of political thriller that he wanted to do, you know, following the book.
Ah.
It turned into a satire, you know, along the way, because there were things that he wrote that were just funny, and he couldn't get around them. You know, they were either so absurd that he couldn't write them out. So then it became a comedy, you know, a black comedy, but a comedy. And so, I mean, Strangelove is the funniest character in the movie.
Sure.
So maybe that's why.
I guess I thought it was an odd choice. I mean, and maybe it's what
like,
do you think?
Well, I like George C. Scott's character personally. He's going to see the big board.
what did you like about the George C. Scott?
The absurdity of it, how he's letting his mistress handle his communications, and then when he goes into the war room and he gets the phone call from her, you know, I told you not to call me in here, and he's there opening a pack of, was it Wrigley's gum or something, and just, I don't know, you think you'd worry about chewing a piece of gum when you have a fleet of B-52s?
Right, I mean, I think he, like,
ingressing in Russia.
I mean, he just represented, you know, the good old apple pie American, you know,
yeah.
Like, at all costs you follow this protocol so you can, you know, whoop some ass or whatever
right.
It is, you know? So, like, you know, blind to everything else.
Yeah, you know, I think that's why he was funny to
well,
me.
Well, you know, he was funny.
You would hope a general is more discerning than that, but
yeah,
he wasn't. And I'm trying to remember the... Everything he did was a... This was one of the major themes for me, that we were our... In that movie, the United States was their own worst enemy. But everything was the Russians' fault. And,
sure.
Oh, they must be doing this. When
right.
We were actually the only aggressor in the whole situation.
Right.
And everything was our own fault. But still, they must be doing something. Mm-hmm. And even after... At the end of it, he's still trying to turn the story to say, well... They're the ones who started this, and now, oh, what's their next move? What, you know, they're plotting something else
right,
here.
Right, right.
And, like, no, they haven't done anything.
Uh-huh.
Right.
So
I really like George C. Scott's character as well, mainly because it's a performance unlike any other he's given in any movie, you
right.
know. And an interesting bit of trivia that I read was... Stanley Kubrick, George C. Scott had a falling out after this movie because Kubrick tricked him into giving those performances because he told him they were practice takes and he wanted him to play them just completely over the top and then, you know, then do the real scene after that. And he used the over the top scenes most of the time when he edited it.
I need to learn more about Kubrick. And it seems like this kind of thing happened a lot.
And the other thing about that you would be interested in, Rob, is that he convinced Scott to... he shamed him into doing a lot of things in the movie he didn't want to do by beating him at chess.
Yes, I read that as well. Yeah, I guess they were both pretty good players.
Yeah, I guess Scott considered himself a pretty good player, and Kubrick just schooled him, so...
Well, another. So we keep saying his character. That was General Turgeson.
Right,
Turgeon.
Turgeon.
That's right.
Turgeson.
That's some good
names. Also, isn't that the name of Sam Kinison's character in Back to School, Professor Turgeson?
Oh,
maybe
I
not.
Don't know.
Maybe it's similar. It's just similar. But
yeah, I don't remember.
That was quite a connection there.
Yeah, yeah, I haven't seen that movie.
How are your pipes wired up there?
Are they
just
are all
just
crossed.
Tall?
And just, water going everywhere.
So I guess to me, I would say, the way it's portrayed to someone who hadn't seen it before, but has only seen the clips, and you got the, you know, the good old Slim Pickens character riding the bomb on, you know, the kind of the
TJ King Kong.
That's right. You know, you see him, and you see you know, there's no fighting in the war room. You hear the funny quotes,
gentlemen.
And so
you can't do that here.
I guess I thought it was going to be sillier somehow. Like, I didn't know it was going to be such, you know, kind of the biting satire that it really was. And so I guess the thing I took away of it and the theme to me of the movie was you had all of these human constructions, the B-52 and the SAC command and where you place the bases and the protocols for the top secret plan R. And then you have the protocols for recalling the top secret plan R and who you're going to call and exactly where the bomb sites are. It's like amazing, I mean, and true as well, technology from that time and technology now, all these human constructs that are put in place, all put together and then completely unable to be controlled by humans. So they have all these protocols for calling back or for executing Plan R, but when they go to execute Plan R, everybody's like, "No, you're not executing Plan R." Like, so you like.
I'll take a pint.
I'll
have another one as well.
You want a mug or a pint?
Same thing.
I'm good. Yeah. Rob, that was the first thing I wrote on my notes was that the monotony of the mission. They were on this very important mission, 24 hours a day, B-52s, nuclear-armed B-52s in the air. They're on this very important mission. They're sitting there. One guy's doing card tricks.
Sure.
When the call comes in, nobody believes it.
Right.
So the monotony of the job is we're up here doing this, and it's extremely important to our national defense, and we're never going to use it.
Uh-huh. Right. Right. And the whole point of having Plan R is so you could just execute Plan R. Like, you're not supposed to ask 400 people whether it should be Plan R, right?
Yeah.
But what happens, everybody, you know, everybody asks, wait, are you really doing this, you know, and then someone comes by, and, you know, so... I think the way that played out kind of in, maybe in the war machine or maybe of like the modern human condition is we're able to create things that are beyond our control. It's a Frankenstein's monster kind of a story, I think. You know, we're able to put together systems that can't be controlled. They have a procedure for calling back the, you know, the Plan R. You hit the three codes in the CRM 114 or whatever it is. You know, but now the radio contact doesn't work, or no one will really send it, or what, I forget why that doesn't. But
it's similar.
Just, there's just the. I mean, there's a lot of human error as well. You got the general with the mistress and the eating the gum, and you know, whatever, and the drunken rush. There's obviously human errors throughout, but that was the one that struck me the most was just the creation of a protocol for it to just fail completely.
I didn't think about this until just now, but Crimson Tide is kind of a ripoff of that same situation, only with submarines.
I guess I never thought of that. But yeah, I guess
instead of airplanes. But strangely, when the movie called Doctor Strange Love, but interesting to me that water fluoridation.
Yes, I was going to bring that up.
Oh, well, I'll let you talk about your movie then.
All right, So one of the general that starts all this, you know, reveals him like drops lots of good quotes in the script, you know, about body fluids and various things, and it turns out he's super worried about fluoridation in the water, the placement of putting fluoride in the water to help your teeth.
That's because he's gone insane, right?
Or has he? So that
it's a thing you hear about all the time now.
Right.
And they've recently just reduced the recommended amount of water fluoridation.
Right. So out of all the dated things, the SAC commands and the B-52s and then the little radio machines and the uniforms and the, you know, the whole thing, I was like, man, we are still fighting about the fluoride in the water, you know? Like I thought that was a... It was an interesting little theme that appeared in there.
Yeah, those conspiracies run deep.
Yeah,
and one of my favorite gags is when they need to call off. They need to call the attack off, and they need to get on the payphone, which is a little bit antiquated. But the only way to get there is the Coca-Cola machine,
right?
And you can't, you know, Coca-Cola company's going to get mad at you, you know, which points to like, you know, the interplay between commerce and the military.
A corporation,
which may lead into our next movie. Perhaps.
All right, I got a couple comments to make before we segue.
Overall, I give it two thumbs up. I mean, it was a lot like, so I have this thing, there to go through a, let's talk about baseball for a second. So I in my current age, when I hear about, you know, great legends of the past, or, you know, a number retired or whatever. Like, so the big thing was when Stan Musial died. You know, everybody talked about what a great player he was. You know, they got his statue out there and the number. Like, I'm a little cynical now. Like, when I was a kid, I just thought Stan Musial, he's great, you know? You know, of course he is. So the guy died, and I remember it was on some weekend. I was like, let me just pop upstairs. I had some time. I was like, let me hit up this guy's wiki page. You know, let me just see about these numbers. I was like, holy crap, these numbers are fantastic, you know? Like, it's amazing what he did. Like, he was Albert Pujols at his best, but twice as long. And, you know, went to war, came back, still awesome. You know, like, like World Series, All-Star games, batting titles, you know, home run king. Like, I was like, okay, I get it. You know, yes, he was a legend. So same thing goes with these movies that, you know, everybody says are so great, you know. And, you know, you got to see this. It's a classic. And so I'm always a little skeptical. Like, is this just old people thinking that their old movie is great, you know?
Right.
So I guess I was pleased, maybe because it had a little Kubrickian kind of filming to it. But, I mean, it's much more than just – it's not a silly satire. It's much more than just like, oh, look at the actors and you know. The dialogue was good. The gags. I wouldn't even call it. I mean, do you laugh when you watch? I didn't laugh at all. But I guess
in
I don't laugh
Doctor
at movies.
Strangelove?
Yeah, I was just
I did
like,
not laugh at that.
I just don't. Maybe I'm not a happy man.
Thing, the big board and the big board. When the president's on the phone and okay, you're fine. Well, I'm glad you're fine. Oh,
right.
Okay. And
yeah.
Just the goofy banter of you think these are the two leaders of.
Right, right. First and second worlds.
Yeah, essentially. And this is the conversation they're having?
Yeah, I did. And actually, that point really, that phone call really struck me. I don't know why. When he's, like, talking to the Russian, he's, like, talking super stilted, you know, are you okay today? You know, like, trying to get the English across. It's just, like, it's
the other another major theme I always saw was that while they're in the war room there, they're fiddling while Rome burns.
Right.
Because they're talking about, well, we can run through all the codes, and that'll take 2.5 days. Yeah. And how many minutes until they penetrate Russian airspace?
20.
18
right.
minutes.
Yeah. Right, just stupidity.
Okay,
right.
Yeah, and then the second thing, bringing it to modern day, how they kept blaming the Russians for everything.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing similar things presently with cyber attacks, cyber warfare. We're always... The Chinese are attacking, North Korea's attacking, the Russian, you know, we're doing all the same things.
Oh, yeah. Right. Sure.
But we act like we're not.
Right.
And so, that was all.
It probably won't make as good of a movie, though, 10 years from now, when they talk about Cisco switches and back doors installed by the government.
I don't know, what about The Net, or what was that called, with Sandra Bullock?
Yeah, The Net, yeah.
But that.
All right, a couple comments. Getting back to what I said earlier about the time capsule, you know, put yourself back in 1964. Another thing that had just kind of wrapped up was, you know, the McCarthy era of, you know, the Red Scare, the second Red Scare. So, you know, there were a lot of people who had very real fears about Russia and about espionage.
Sure.
and communist infiltration of our society.
Sure.
And our government, and you know, so that was a real thing. But I think by 1964, like, a lot of that had subsided. There was some backlash against it, you know, people were now viewing it as the witch hunt that it really was.
Right.
And so all of the anti-Rusky kind of propaganda that's in this movie, I think, speaks directly to that.
Sure.
And that would have had that would have carried a lot more weight for somebody then than it does now.
And I guess to think about it, people of our age, like, we grew up kind of in the waning era of the Cold War, but we remember the nuclear war paranoia and the duck under the
Sure.
desk. So it resonates. I mean,
yeah.
for the next
Right.
generation,
the,
like the, you know, 9/11 is their thing.
The
know?
Cold War was real, right?
Right.
To us,
right?
But maybe back then, you know, the Nazis were real.
Yeah.
The Russian threat was not so real.
Mm-hmm.
But this movie was intended to bridge the gap between the two, you know.
Maybe why the black and white. I think that's a decent answer. That's the best answer I've heard.
But he uses color at the end, right? I mean, there are spots of color in the film when he's showing all of the nuclear test explosions.
It didn't show up black and white. It showed up black and white for me, but maybe you got a...
Well, I have an HD TV, Rob. That was
no, yeah,
but maybe
that's probably it.
Maybe, I don't know, maybe you have, like, if you bought it, maybe you got, like, are you sure it wasn't in some special cuts or some bonus?
Super high def,
I'll have to
holographic,
watch it again.
Blu-ray, purple ray.
Maybe the whiskey was hitting in by then, was right then.
Probably what it was.
But yeah, it was black and white for me.
So the last thing I wanted to say about this movie was, when we were still preparing for this show and trying to pick movies, I had sent Rob a couple of links. One was to the top 10 liberal movies and the top 10 libertarian movies. And this one appears on both lists, and I thought that was interesting.
See ya.
Because, I mean, which do you think it is? Is it a liberal movie or is it a libertarian movie?
My God, I wouldn't say it was either, really. I mean, I guess, would you say it was on the liberal list because it's mocking the military? I mean, was that what? You...
That's how I would see it.
Okay.
It's mocking the war machine.
Yeah. Okay. That's not really my issue.
And the danger of nuclear weapons.
Right. That's just not my fight in the liberal world.
Yeah.
So why would it be a libertarian? Just the government out of control?
Yeah. That you can't trust government to do anything right. Yeah. So I just thought that was interesting. It was on both lists.
And I just wanted to build consensus amongst the podcast. Peace in the Midwest, if you will.
That's what we do here. Okay, moving on to movie number two. This was my movie. And both these guys made me regret picking it.
We're just being whiny.
What? Oh, come on.
Because it is a little bit daunting. It's called The Corporation. It's a documentary, so, you know, you have to be into documentaries. And it's 2.5 hours long, so, you know, you got to be committed to stick with it.
I might be committed after watching it.
Yeah, right? So it is primarily a documentary about the evils of corporations in America. And I think one of the most interesting devices it uses is the DSM, which is the diagnostic manual that psychotherapists use to diagnose any kind of, you know, psychological or psychiatric
disorders.
Yes. Yeah. And so there's a checklist for diagnosing someone as a psychopath. And it's a very well-defined, well-understood checklist. And the producers of the film use this checklist against the legal person that corporations have become in this country under law to basically diagnose corporations as psychopaths. They make the point that, you know, if a corporation is a person, sure, it's a person, but it's a psychopathic person.
And let us reference the Romney quote in the last campaign where he was caught on films, you know, saying, you know, corporations are people.
Right.
My friend is what he said condescendingly. You know, so how to help you lead into the movie, it you know, it starts by discussing, and you'll do better at this, about how the legal definition of corporations is people. That, you know, goes all the way back to 1890 and 1910. And I guess I didn't know that history, and it was never brought up to me when that scandal hit during the Romney campaign. I guess it wasn't a scandal, it was just kind of a funny quote. Not a funny, it was a noteworthy quote.
Right.
It was like, you know, these corporations are taking over us people, and, you know, Romney's corporations are people. Well, now I see Romney knows the 14th Amendment. He knows this history. That's probably what he's referring to. Of course, he's Romney, so he doesn't understand how clunky that's going to come out to, you know. But I never made the connection between that quote, I thought, you know, and the legal history.
Yeah, so I would encourage our listeners to at least watch maybe the first 40 minutes of this film so that you get that part of it anyway.
Say an hour. There's,
yeah, you know, maybe the first hour. So it is a person. And then, so, I mean, spend some time thinking about a person that has all of these rights of a regular person, but they have none of the accountability, and they live forever.
Right. Now that's until they go out of business.
That's a recipe for disaster,
yeah.
Right? So the movie gets preachy in places, I think, where they start talking about the environmental impacts the corporations have, and I don't deny any of that. I don't deny that they do have... you know, they refer to it by the economic term externalities, which is what, you know, an economist would call it. Anything that a corporation does that affects people around them that they don't have to pay for, like pollution and, you know,
roads.
Yeah,
roads.
And
you didn't. Another, you didn't build that type of situation.
Right.
Only that's a goal of the corporation.
Exactly.
Instead of a hit on your success.
Maybe. Yeah, and so, I mean, I've obviously said on the show many times, I'm no fan of corporations. In my mind, they are a creation of government. They are, in many cases, an agent of the government. So, I think we should do away with them. But maybe not for all of the reasons that are called out in this movie. I think the producers, the writers had some serious axes to grind, and you know, and they ground them. They for 2.5 hours they ground them. But it does make some pretty interesting points, and you know, for anybody that's looking for ammunition against corporations, this is a pretty rich source.
Well, one thing that you're talking about, the environmental impacts, at the 35-minute mark, there's a quote, "Until the environmental conditions become a commodity that is traded, corporations won't worry about that."
Right.
Well, that's what now there is, that is happening.
Yeah.
With the carbon credits.
Right.
But there are corporations formed to trade carbon credits, so what? How do you trust that corporation?
Right. Another thing I wrote down in my notes was, go ahead, Rob. If you had a comment, I got to look this up real quick.
So, as I always seek to make connections on the Midwest peace process, I mean, I thought that it had the same, the way I connected this Dr. Strangelove movie to the corporation was. The same sort of idea. Probably the most striking moment for me was when it was talking about pollution, but not necessarily that quote, but the fact that I think it was good old Noam Chomsky, the old saw up there, you know, was talking about was that all the individuals at the corporation, I mean, they might be great people, they might give back to the community, whatever else that they want to do. Maybe they're good people, maybe they don't even like what the corporation does. But when they're acting in service of the corporation, all they do is push the corporation's agenda.
Right.
In the same way that with the My Strangelove theme, like this is something that can't be controlled. Like they don't have, you know, it's almost like the corporation lives outside of the union of the people that are there. You could have a lot of people that
right.
you know love the stream, but when it's time to make the business decision, you need to make the most money for the corporation regardless of the stream.
Right.
That's your job when you're at the job. You just go and do it.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a little bit analogous to some of the Strangelove stuff. I mean, a lot of the people there knew they were doing the wrong thing, but that was what they were trained for, and that was their role. So they just went ahead and did it.
Yeah, they asked the question in there that, you know, I mean, it's a big deal now for companies to be green, right?
Right.
To tout how much they're doing for the environment, how, you know, how their products are sustainable or,
yeah.
you know, whatever. They asked the question in the movie is, are companies doing that because they have a conscience and because they actually care?
No.
Or are they doing it because it improves their position in the marketplace? They can outflank their competition
yeah.
by claiming that they're green and their competition isn't.
You right.
know, what is really driving that? And I mean, it's hard to say because you know one of the people they interview is Ray Anderson, who is the CEO of Interface, and they're the largest maker of carpet in the United States. And, you know, I mean, he talks quite a bit about his own personal epiphany, you know, about how his company was raping the environment and using it, you know, for his benefit, but not caring about the consequences. And one day he just made the decision, we're not going to do this anymore. We're going to find a way to make our company sustainable or we're going to go out of business. Okay, great. Number one, do I believe him? He seems sincere in the interviews,
yeah.
maybe. But number two, can he actually pull it off?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
and probably not. And mm-hmm. if he can't, then what? He's just yeah. going to pull the plug and dissolve his corporation and, you know, find something else to do?
Sure.
I don't think so.
That's exactly what he...
To me, I kept coming back to this Romney quote. And I wish I knew what whoever was challenging Romney at that time. But when he said... To me, when he said... Corporations are people, my friend. I think it had two meanings to me now that I saw this movie. One was that he probably understood the legal construct, the legal definition of corporations and how corporations have rights. And I think the other thing he was trying to humanize the corporate motive. That corporations, hey, these are people that live in your community too, and they care about your streams and rivers, and they want the best for the schools as well. You know, and I think that's I think that's completely wrong. And it comes back to what I've kind of said on the podcast a number of times. I think corporations are great. You know, I think they do their thing. I think that's their job to make money. They need to make as much money as possible. My complaint, my worry, and probably what makes me the liberal guy out of all of this, is I completely reject the idea that we just turn, if the corporations are making money, then things got to be good. If they're not making money, things got to be bad. I don't make that moral equivalence that seems to happen so much in the conservative world, that if corporations are thriving, then the country is strong. If they're not, then it's weak. And I think you need some strong corporations, but that doesn't define a strong country. It defines strong corporations. That's it. They're just they're an entity unto themselves that do a thing. Like I really like the analogy of like a shark. You know, if a shark goes and what do sharks eat? Squid or something? I don't know.
Everything.
Sure, everything. So if a shark comes and finds a squid and chomps it up, like, do you feel bad? Like, is the shark being evil? Like, do you feel bad for the squid? No, the shark just does what the shark does. You know, I don't you. But that doesn't mean you.
By the way, a squid is a predator too. So.
Of other things.
Yeah.
You saved it.
But you could save.
You saved it. Okay. I woke you up though.
But you don't allow. You don't place more authority and you don't hand over your nation or your community or your standing as a person over to that corporation. It's just a thing. It's a thing that does what it does. So to me, that means you might need something that controls that thing if you don't want to go crazy. And to me, the best thing to control that thing, if it can do it at all, is the government. And so that's
what
essentially
controls
my
government. Then, oh, the people control
the people.
The government. Yeah,
yeah,
they're doing a great
right.
job of that.
Democracy.
Yeah,
I'm not saying it works perfectly, but that essentially that defines my liberal credo, at least in the Bush era.
So there, towards the end of the movie, they interview some gal. I don't even remember who it is, but she makes the point. I think they were at some kind of town hall meeting or something, and they were interviewing people that were at the meeting. And at the end of it, she said, you know, you can't trust corporations. And then she goes on to say, so that's why you have to put your trust in your government. You know, to step in these situations and save all of us from the corporation. And, you know, so,
right.
I mean, I watch that and of course, I throw my hands up and
yeah.
say, well, okay, they're the same thing, first of all.
Right.
And you can't trust either one of them. So, I mean, if there was something in the movie I disagreed with the most, it's that quote. I also thought that... you know, Michael Moore makes an appearance in this film, and they interview
Ooh.
Him. There's, yeah, two or three segments of him. I'm not a big fan of Michael Moore, but, you know, I will say it was interesting, the comments he made, towards the end of the movie. He talks about how, he didn't use these words, but he basically says, look, I'm a hypocrite, because I'm appearing in this film about the evils of corporations, and yet that's how I make my money. You know, they pay me to make movies that they can distribute and put people in theaters so that the corporation can make money. And, you know, I mean, what he's trying to say is that the corporation is blind to everything, all the issues, you know.
It's just a machine.
Except the money.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they care about
right.
is the money. So they're fine producing a film about how corporations are evil. As long as they're making money
yep.
off of it,
mm-hmm.
they're good.
They're serving their job, yeah.
But, you know, I read between the lines of that and say, yeah, okay, Michael Moore, you're in a movie about how evil corporations are making money, and that's what you do. You
yeah.
make money. So
well, he's shown his hypocrisy in his own...
Oh yeah,
his own documentary. So
oh yeah,
nothing.
Yeah,
really
and
new,
frankly, he stopped making documentaries
well,
a long
yeah,
time ago.
His propaganda,
right?
I
he makes
say.
Propaganda films.
Yeah.
He's good at it, though.
He is
propaganda.
I don't even think it's... That's what I don't understand why people think his propaganda is good, because if you just watch the movie, it doesn't work. Maybe that's because it's. His positions are usually counter to mine, so I automatically discount what he's saying.
Right,
but
right.
but when I'm watching it, I'm not. I don't even start thinking. Well, maybe he has a point. It's like no, that's completely false.
Right. That's interesting.
You're saying this, this, and this, and it doesn't add up to this. But you're saying you need to go do this.
Right.
And so that doesn't
That's interesting.
Work
I don't think, we, I don't think we've ever talked about this before, but yeah, it works differently for me because it's like, it strums all my strings,
yeah,
you know?
Your favorite uncle.
You know, and I'm kind of like, like the BS detector is certainly going off, but it feels so good, you know?
Oh, Rob. Well, I just have a few things about the corporation. I watched almost the whole movie with a couple of naps sprinkled in there. They talk about, in the olden days, the fire departments were, it was a private industry. And
right.
Jerry, I was just curious what you thought about that, because that is something you posed as far as security and police.
Yep.
What did you think what they had to say about the private fire departments back in the day? And one of the quotes was, we certainly don't want to go back to that.
Yeah, I remember that. We certainly do want to go to that, frankly.
Right.
You know, Benjamin Franklin started the first volunteer fire department in the United States, and it was a model that was successful and was copied in all the major cities in the colonies. But like they said in the movie, if you contracted with the fire department, they gave you a badge that you displayed on the outside of your house. And then if you call the fire department and they show up to your house, if they don't see that badge, your house burns to the ground. Sorry, you didn't pay us, so we're not going to help you out. I see nothing wrong with that model.
Okay.
Now, I recognize that my house burning could potentially start your house burning, or vice versa. So it's almost, I mean, I thought about this while I was watching the movie. It almost fits into our recent episode about vaccinations, right? That if I don't pay a fire department to help me put the fire out on my house, I'm endangering your house,
mm-hmm.
right? I think
your house is already fireproof.
like Chris Rock said, I don't need the fire department. I keep my sprinklers on 24 hours a day. I got a nice moist house.
All right, go on.
So I think that if that were the norm still, if volunteer fire departments were still the norm,
yep.
I think we would have come up with some free market way of protecting everybody, especially in densely populated areas.
Sure.
You know, there would be some system that you could buy into that would probably even cost you less because there were a lot more people involved. You know, I won't pretend to speculate on how that would work, but
I obviously
think that
it'd be better.
Well, it's better in the sense that you're paying for the service that you're using,
yeah.
versus tax money being taken from you at gunpoint. And, you know, while fire protection may be one of those bona fide services that, you know.
Oh, yeah, I know all about it. They just raised the tax in Maryland Heights for fire.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they really. Yeah, I don't want to get into that. Go on.
Well, no, that's. I mean, I don't have a problem with us going back to that system. I don't think it's all that.
Okay.
Anachronistic, you know.
Right. I was just curious because that really caught my attention when they were talking about that, and because I knew that would be counter to your thoughts on it.
Right. So, I mean, it wouldn't be a badge anymore that you hang on your house. It would probably be GPS based. They'd look up your address and find, you know, where you are on the map, and like, oh yeah, that guy paid. Let's go get in the truck.
So then you'd have people hacking somebody else's GPS signal, and then, you know, fire
whatever.
Protection. But another. Well, two other things. This is more for entertainment value, but in the corporation, they were talking about this drug given to cows called Posilac.
Right.
To help them produce more milk, even though dairy farmers were paid not to produce as much milk. So it was this weird situation that I'm sure is going on in other crops, you know, but paid not to produce as much corn, but
yeah.
Hey, let's increase the yield of corn, so whatever. But they were talking about some of the side effects of this drug and how it was causing these infections on the udders and...
Right, and they show some pretty...
getting into milk.
Right.
I I am trying to cut back on the amount of soda I drink. So I happened to be drinking a glass of milk last night as I was watching that section.
No.
And I did not finish that glass of milk. I mean, that's how...
That's unfortunate.
Obviously, that's a... You know, just it was goofy that right. I'm not going to drink this milk anymore. But
yeah,
that was not a pleasant thing to see.
Add that to the long list of evils of the corporation, right? I'd encourage our listeners to watch another movie called Food Inc. That also delves into those issues, specifically Tyson and how they raise chickens, which you know is a subject near and dear to my heart. That you know the fact that the chickens are raised inside a 1 square foot cage, and that's all the space they get for their entire life. And they have to pump them full of antibiotics to keep them from getting sick and dying because they're packed in so tightly into, you know, the barns that they're in.
Yep.
They're given growth hormones, you know, so that they get bigger because really it's the chicken breast that most people want to eat. And a natural chicken that's out there free range and eating grass, chicken breasts don't grow that big, you know, like
Well, out in L.A., they do.
Or they need to hit the bench press.
Yeah, they are augmented.
Oh.
Let's say that. And it's, you know, it's the corporations driving that kind of practice because that's what sells.
Yeah.
That's what the fast food restaurants want. That's what consumers want when they go into the store. You know, they want to buy a 1 pound chicken breast. Chicken breasts aren't supposed to be a pound. They're not. They're like 4 ounces when they come off a normal chicken.
Near and dear. So, maybe one more thought before the break here on that very issue was I was, if you listen to the Cardinal game, as all people should, it's just kind of your right and duty. So there's a commercial on the KMOX that's all about how things start as a farmer from, you know, just hits up the schlocky home warm all-American feeling, like, but if the popcorn you're snuggling with your family to watch a movie to the the bread on the hamburger bun on 4th of July, you know, it's like they just took the word salad of Americana and threw it together, and they just keep connecting it to the farmer. It all started with a farmer. Well, was this put out by, you know, the Farmers Bureau
Monsanto
brought to you by Monsanto. So I'm like, wait a second, that commercial wasn't for me. It's not for me. It's not for me to listen to. That's a commercial to gain trust with farmers. They're telling the farmers the same story to themselves.
Right.
You know, they're replaying the farmer legend to the farmer to be like, you know, that Monsanto's not so bad. Maybe we'll buy those seeds or buy that Roundup or whatever it is.
Monsanto in that movie.
Yes, in light of this movie and that weird commercial, I'm like, who are they advertising here?
You brought up Roundup. There's a funny video going around on the internet about he's a lobbyist for, is it DuPont or Monsanto who makes Roundup?
Monsanto.
Yeah. Right. And he's being interviewed, and he actually says Roundup isn't harmful. You could drink a cup of it; it would be fine. Yeah, sure. So the interviewer then runs with that. He's like, "Oh, well, we have some Roundup here. You know,
let's do it."
And then I don't. I mean, you can drink it, but, you know, it's safe. And it's like, no, you just said it's you would be happy to drink some. And so the interviewer keeps pressing on it. Well, the guy eventually says, you know, this is absurd, and storms out of the interview.
Right.
But it is great because that's what they're peddling. And
that's
a lobbyist paid by a corporation to say these things that obviously aren't true. But that's okay because it just warms us up and gives us that nice feeling that everything's going to be fine.
Right.
But the other one thing I wanted to talk about from the corporation was the drinking water in Bolivia. I thought that was interesting because we're seeing pieces of that here in the United States. So in Bolivia, they had a water crisis.
Right.
It was contracted out to a private company to...
Bechtel.
We'll say it again.
Bechtel.
Bechtel. All right. Sorry, Rob. I didn't mean to bore you with this.
Sorry.
To remedy the situation, well, suddenly they own all the water, including rain.
Right. And, which is so absurd its face.
And these poor Bolivians are being prosecuted for collecting rainwater.
Right.
And say, you know, you don't own that. Well, it pretty much resulted in rioting, if not all-out civil war.
Yeah.
We've seen hints of that in the western United States. There were stories of farmers collecting rainwater, and or just some, they weren't all farmers, but people collecting rainwater on their property, and they were told to cease and desist, that somehow that was illegal. The EPA shows up, and why is that illegal to collect some rainwater?
That's an excellent question.
So to bring it back to the Monsanto, the exact same thing happened with the recent Supreme Court case. It was a year or so ago with the farmer who bought the Monsanto seed. I'm okay with that.
Terminator seed.
Is that what it is? I don't know. And so Monsanto sells a seed that's supposed to be all that. You know, fine. They can work the genetics and sell their seed. Well, then, you know, farmers would plant this, and it would, you know, as nature does, as I understand nature, which I don't really, seeds will talk to each other, and birds and bees happen, you know, and then the pastures around your Monsanto sanctioned, you know, field can be, you know, kind of cross pollinated,
right? And so if you're a farmer using the Roundup Ready Monsanto seed, and you're next to a farmer who's not using it. You wind up with that cross-pollination.
Right.
And
so the person who didn't buy it was trying to sell it without giving their cut to Monsanto for the Roundup seed. And Roundup's like, no, our stuff's in there. You know, it was a natural process where the corporation was, you know, putting their grimy hands in there. It was very much like the rainwater thing.
Well,
like, it wasn't like Bechtel was owning the water pipes.
So that's different from the Terminator seed I brought up. I didn't realize. Okay.
But it's a little bit, you know, you could understand if Bechtel put the plumbing in and put it into the houses and put the water tank. But it was like no, it's not water. It's so we're just going to own the water.
Well, and then there's a parallel story to that, which is documented in Food Inc., where... You know, farmers that are saving their seed to use the next season are being prosecuted by Monsanto because they're saying, look, you didn't pay for that. You can't use that seed. You have to buy new seed from us every season.
Yep. Yep.
That's the contract you entered into when you bought it the first time. And I was like, well, wait a minute. You didn't tell me that when I bought it.
So that's
gone to court in a couple of different jurisdictions. And, yeah, okay, so another... Add that to the list of the evil corporation.
I was curious why you picked it.
Mainly because I wanted you guys to watch it.
But... it seemed an odd choice, I guess.
I'm anti-corporation.
Like, right.
So are the producers of this movie. Like I said at the beginning... They are anti for some reasons I don't agree with, but, you know, I share that core belief with them that corporations are bad.
But why do you think in your utopian paradise of everything being a business that corporations wouldn't just arise out of the ashes of that?
Well,
like why wouldn't Bechtel just say, hey, you know, like why all the evils? Why wouldn't they naturally arise in the best case scenario of what you dream of?
They are given special privileges within our society because of their corporate charters that are created by the government. They are government created entities, and if they weren't, they wouldn't have all of those privileges. There would be no corporate veil that would have to be pierced in order to hold officers of the corporation liable for their behavior like we currently have. If they were just a company of individuals, all of the individuals would be liable for their actions.
We're gonna have to put that one on the show list.
All right.
because that seems a little. I understand the connection between the corporations and the government and the way they're kind of working together as the documentary shows.
Right.
You know, to kind of, you know, mutually sustain each other. I completely agree with that, but I don't see why there wouldn't be a Monsanto in the way you see Jerry World. That there wouldn't, and maybe it wouldn't be enforced by fancy lawyers paid by them, but maybe it'd be enforced by dudes with guns that says, "Hey, you can't plant that seed. That would just burn your house." You know what? Burn your.
Maybe. But then, you know, it wouldn't be under color of law. It wouldn't be Monsanto exercising their intellectual property rights that are being enforced by the government. It would be them, you know, making unreasonable claims against their customers, which would hurt their reputation in the marketplace.
Well, here's something I didn't know. They talk about this more than once in the documentary, that corporations are required by law to put profits first. How does that manifest itself? Because I have never...
I didn't think that was... That seemed a little tenuous.
I think because shareholders have a reasonable expectation of dividends. And that's part of the charter, the document that creates the corporation. They say, we are going to, you know, produce profit and we are going to pay dividends to our shareholders. And so...
Okay, but if I can do this and pay you a dollar, or I can do this, which is morally acceptable or morally better somehow, and pay you 75 cents, what does the law say? It says, no, don't do that?
Well, I don't think that seems becomes...
Okay, and that's how it was presented documentary.
It seemed dicey.
Yeah, so I didn't know.
Well, you know, the exact amount of dividends is not specified by law.
No, but that's the takeaway,
right?
Of the statement, they're required by law to put profits.
But the higher your dividends, the more people are going to buy your stock.
Sure.
And the more capital you're going to have to do
whatever. I get all that. Yeah. But to say they're required by law to put profits first, I would like to know more about that.
Maybe they're just drawing this distinction between that and a 501c3, which is a nonprofit corporation that is specifically chartered not to make money.
Yeah, but that's a strong that statement has implications that I don't think are true.
Maybe, yeah. That's a fair comment. I'm not disputing it. I'm just trying to...
I feel like you're not explaining it in a way I find acceptable.
All right. Okay, we are going to take a break, and when we come back, we will cover our third and final movie, which is Syriana. And we'll also dig into some listener feedback. So stay with us. We are back. The next movie in our lineup is Jeremy's pick.
The best one of all, yeah.
Syriana. Introduce the movie for us.
Tell us about
and for
it.
Our listeners Syriana, who haven't seen it.
Syriana is nearly a follow-on to my last pick of Charlie Wilson's War.
I did see the parallels.
This picks up where Charlie Wilson's War
And let
War
me interject
off.
For anyone who hasn't listened, last year we did an At the Movies episode. It's episode 72, so go back and check that out. It's on our website.
Well, who wouldn't have listened to that? I mean,
obviously,
kind of
they've all heard it. I know that, but
Yeah. Charlie Wilson's War talks about Afghanistan back when we fought a covert, a proxy war, what do you,
covert
against
the
Russians.
Yeah.
And then just bailed out on it.
And created Osama bin Laden.
Now, this is not Afghanistan. This is largely Iran that is central to the plot of Syriana. But it shows how the oil industry, the plot is that the oil industry, what the role is of the oil industry in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And how a corporation,
right.
Jerry...
And corruption
plays into feeding terrorism,
right?
For to be blunt about it. So you have many plot lines in this movie, which really roiled Rob.
A lot of things roiled me. That wasn't it. But keep going.
You have George Clooney as a CIA agent. Interesting character. He's one of the old school guys. You have attorneys, you have oil companies, you have princes, and you have business people in this movie. And it really shows all the links how... Rob, just, what Rob?
I'm writing notes.
Oh, okay. You looked interested. I was confused.
Sorry.
Shows the role that our government plays in essentially helping out these businesses, yet on the other end, they're investigating the business for corruption and wrongdoing. The movie fascinates me because I think it's very true to life, to what we've seen play out in the news, and my perception of what happens in the Middle East. I don't feel like it was over the top in anything. It seemed pretty legitimate in the way it went about all of the plot lines. Go ahead, Rob, tear it apart.
I enjoyed the movie. Very nice movie. I have more artistic quibbles with the movie.
Not again. You did the same thing with Charlie Wilson's War.
That movie was also bad artistically.
Oh, my gosh. Talk about the... Go on. Peddle your wares.
I don't think the movie was... There were a lot of characters, and it was a little bit tough to understand exactly what all the plot lines were and exactly what all the subtexts were.
Sure.
And I thought it was just me because I'm actually really terrible. Like when I watch Ocean's 11 or something, I don't know if you guys need to start with
Ocean's 5.
That's right, exactly. Like on the little twist, like I never see the twist coming, no matter what the twist is. Like it could be in like it's like Disney Planes, and I have no idea what the grand finale is going to be. Like I just don't. It's a thing. I just. So I mean that's part of it, but
nowhere the way the no real twists in this movie.
No, not so much.
No, but there's a lot of hidden agendas. There's a lot of, you know, this lawyer is going to say this to this person in this context.
I will grant you that this is one of those movies you need to watch more than once to really comprehend what
was
going on.
And it was a little bit tough on a first viewing. To really keep track of who all the players were and exactly what all
their hidden motives. Last year I warned you that this would be my next movie. But
I had a whole year to prepare.
Yeah,
you should have watched it two or three times before.
I've seen the movie several times, so maybe that's why I really like this movie. But go on.
I guess I have artistic quibbles with that part of it, and I think that there's a subplot that has to do with Pakistani migrant workers that become disenfranchised by the corporate merger and get kind of thrown out a little bit and then get brought in by the Islamists, you know, the radical Islamists who then go and carry out the attack. I thought, like, out of all the nuance from the other storylines, I thought that was the most. It's a little bit cartoonish. I thought out of all of them, you know, it was a little bit how we imagine that all happening in some way.
Maybe it seems like to me they're recruited and
right. Whereas I thought the other storylines I thought were more complex, I guess.
And I think some of the dialogue was, I mean, talking about the Doctor Strangelove and some of the lines were really good. I mean, there were little moments in there, like I thought it was fascinating when the Saudi prince said that the president was on him for creating, you know, creating jobs in his states, and they had to buy, you know, overpriced airplanes. I thought was an interesting concept.
Well,
and so it raised a topic that I never really thought of before, of the idea that the West may be just, you know, putting their thumb on the rich oil companies in the
right.
Middle East to essentially, you know, yeah, you're rich, but you're not going to be anything, you know.
Let's the Thursday edition of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which I'm no fan of this newspaper, but headline here, Boeing fighter gets boost. Kuwait expected $3 billion Super Hornet order. Keep the production line going in St. Louis for another couple of years. There you go. So maybe somebody told the old Kuwaiti king, is that King Abdullah, or am I mixing up my kingdoms?
Abdullah is
Saudi,
I think.
Yeah. All right. Well, then the guy in Kuwait.
Yeah. What is the, since we're talking on titles, what does the name Syriana mean to? Like, why do you think that was the title?
I don't know. I've thought about that. I've actually thought about that.
So I think there were real. It was really weird that out of, you know, they scope around all, you know, around the globe, and they put the little caption down there where they are.
Right.
But it was always like Arab state or something. You know,
right.
The Saudi Arabia, you know, was always not really Saudi Arabia. It seemed, you know. So I wonder if it's, you know, referring to kind of, you know, you know.
Well, but they specifically talked about Iran.
Sure, but they never really said that Saudi Arabia is part of that Gulf state.
So, like, you're saying they didn't want to step on the toes of the
somehow.
Saudis.
And I was like, the Syriana is almost like a fictional name of the, or maybe non-fictional name of the region.
Yeah, that's kind of the way I interpret it, too.
Very close to Syria, though.
Right, yeah, right. It's like Syria and the...
Syria and...
and its suburbs.
Right. The burbs.
Some of the one thing that stood out to me as a theme in the movie is maybe you are not who you think you are. The lawyer, Bennett... He's charged with finding the corruption, and his father is an alcoholic in the movie, and he's very strict, very stern with his father when his father shows up on his doorstep. By the end of the movie, he's a little more gentle with him because he realized he has to do some things that he didn't think he would find himself doing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not the guy I thought I was.
You think that altered his relationship with his father?
I think that's what it was trying to say. I like that idea. I just don't think it was carried off well artistically. I got the
impression there was probably more scenes shot with that, and they didn't make it into the movie. You know,
it's too sprawling. It's a little bit like your movie, Jerry. It needed an editor. It needed the tight dialogue. It needed the like with in the Strangelove when old Buck Turgeson's talking. You know, you get the shot of the mistress and he's on the pot. You know, and he wants to come out like there's ways in art and there's ways in literature and film that you can cram a lot of detail about what's going on without going through. Without spending a lot of time, without, you know...
Yeah, that's how you've done it in all the big movies you've made.
I just know that's how it works. I'm not saying I can execute it. I'm saying this is poorly executed. I'm a critic. I don't have to actually create anything.
No, I know what you're saying. There are some shortcuts you can, you know...
Right, and so with the whole alcoholic father thing, it's like, what is this getting me? Like, I never really got that character.
I think I just explained it, but that's fine. All right.
It didn't come across for me.
Okay, well, no, you only watched it once, so...
I had not picked up on that, and I think you're right. I think he did change in, you know, from the first time you see his father to the end when he, like, invites him in at, you know, into his house, and, I hadn't really considered that, so you're right.
But back to the political stuff, they did all the same things that we see in the news. The CIA agent, played by George Clooney, starts going off the reservation a little bit, and they immediately pull back, start to discredit
him,
start to put some distance in there. Is almost a direct quote from the movie. Hey, let's put some distance between us and Bob.
So, it, but,
Hillary Clinton is presently doing that with the Clinton Foundation.
Right.
And all the money that's flowing in.
So it's interesting you put it that way, that he went off the reservation.
That's the way they put it, too.
Well, right. That's the way they put it.
Yeah.
But that's not really what happened.
No,
they
it's
asked
not what happened
him
at
to
all.
Do something, and when it didn't turn out exactly the way they wanted, then they cut him loose and just left him twisting in the wind.
Right. Which
okay.
is what the CIA is known to do.
Right.
You've seen throughout history that
so,
that's what they do.
I did not know when I started watching the film. It wasn't until the end and the credits started rolling mm-hmm. that I saw it was based on a book, See No Evil, by Robert Baer. I've read that book. And you know, some of this stuff then suddenly made
okay.
you know, some more sense to me. But it's been a long time since I read it because he published that. It was right after 9/11 that he published that book.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember a lot of the details from it, but I remember liking the book.
You still have it? Because clearly I have not read that book.
No, yeah, I can loan it to you.
All right.
But it is about the fact that, you know, what he was tasked with doing, he was a agent in the northern tribal regions of Afghanistan during the Mujahideen period.
Mm.
That was his bread and butter, you know. And when things went south, they did kind of the same thing to him too. They
sure.
you know, they tried to cut him loose and, you know, make him a martyr. So
right.
Yeah, it wasn't until the end of the movie that I made that connection, but
and this was a separate from that, going back to Bennett the lawyer, and there's a character Dean Whiting. He's the old crusty white guy who's the partner in the law firm, or the
right.
Founder, I think, actually, founding partner. He gets introduced to Bennett.
It's Christopher Plummer, right?
No. Is it? Yeah, it might be. Yeah, yeah. I was thinking of Chris Cooper, who's also in the movie.
Yeah.
But, so anyway, when he meets Bennett, he doesn't shake his hand.
Yeah.
And I never noticed that before until
I
just
noticed it right
and
away.
It's a very awkward moment because Bennett extends and then he gets essentially rejected
right.
and kind of pulls back, and so he's charged with finding the dirt, but yet he's a nobody to this
yeah.
lawyer and,
right.
and this is
what do you think there was a racial component to that too?
Yeah, I
sure.
think there was, of course there was yeah.
I mean, just because they were like in a club, some kind of private club, right,
right?
Bunch of old white guys sitting around at the table
yeah.
and
yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I thought that struck me right away, that little moment.
And the other major theme, of course, is that so you have two princes, not the song. But
golly.
Oh man, I'm gonna have to insert that in post production.
One of them is well educated, has a plan for what he would love to do for his country. The other is just a playboy style, you know, wants, hey, look at this new car I bought, kind of a thing. And what does the United States do? Well, doing the bidding of the corporation, the oil company, they bump off the prince who should be the rightful leader, the one who has plans, wants to improve things for his country, because his agenda doesn't fit with the United States,
right?
Or the oil company.
I love that theme. I thought that theme was effective and.
I'm good.
I'm all set. I thought that was effective and hit home a little bit. I mean, did you find any kind of lack of believability about that was enough to drop a drone hellfire on the poor guy?
It was. I don't think that was well established in the movie, as well established as it could have been.
Right.
But you hear Matt Damon's character, who kind of hard to explain what he, for lack of a better term, he's a financial analyst, planner.
Right.
He's with the smart, what I would call the smart mm-hmm. prince, Prince Nazir.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Thanks. So, for confirming that, Rob. He's saying, it's happening right now. He's on the phone with his wife. It's happening right now. We have 9 of 11 generals. So it was almost a coup situation.
Right.
So maybe you could say, well, the United States sees, oh, military coup, we can't have that going on. So
what would the U.S. case be for doing that thing? I read on the good old Wikipedia that they were trying to tie him to the missing weapon.
Right, which but was a fabricated story to set up Bob, was the way I read that. Bob, the CIA, George Clooney's character. So the way I read that was a fabrication.
Yeah.
You're not buying that, obviously.
On first viewing, that completely didn't connect for me.
Okay.
Me, because I was like an idiot when I watched movies. But I don't know if it connected for you. As effective as the theme was, that the government, the military industrial complex, as portrayed here, that the military was essentially doing the bidding of the corporations
the oil
company. Like that's an effective message, but it didn't carry through to me that I really thought that they would really then say, oh, you know, this is good for the country. Let's go predator drone this guy.
Well, maybe I might be reading in too much, and some of this I'm reading on the fly as I think about the movie, but there's a component in there of them signing the deal with China.
Yeah.
For access to those oil fields in Kazakhstan, right?
Right.
Well, we like to say China's our ally, but they're not.
But I guess
economically,
okay,
we don't want that. So,
hey,
this prince wants to work with China. We don't want that.
I get all that. Okay, so we've seen lots of reports of UAV drone and even not so much Hellfire bombings on civilian houses and where people are that we want to kill, right? But the way the CIA presents that to us, or the government presents that to the American citizenry, was this guy's a terrorist. He was harboring bombs. Like, I've never heard it be like, well, he was a prince that was going to coup the government.
But they did. That's why they tied him to the terrorist who bought the second missile.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying. It
might be just me, but that connection was so tenuous. I had no idea that was even a plausible.
I agree, and I'm not sure I got that out of watching it just once.
Okay.
But I really like the movie. I've seen it probably half a dozen times.
So
I could still be way off on my analysis.
No, I think you're right. On a silly note, why do you think they made Clooney fat?
All right, you brought this up in Charlie Wilson's War.
You made Tom Hanks fat. You like fat stars.
You were not talking about Tom Hanks. You did talk about him, but you also talked about Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Well, he's always fat. But he was fatter.
But, right, and you don't like the... You want the James Bond-style agent, and none of these movies have that. And
right,
I think
so
that's more legit.
That was and that's why I was asking, I mean, it's obviously very intentional. George Clooney is a Hollywood actor. He's a specimen meant for lenses. He's not Joe Schmo me with a cheeseburger,
Wasn't Clooney one of the producers on the film?
He was,
right. So, I mean, it was his choice to portray the character that way.
But why? Why do you think?
Well, I think it was a lot more believable.
Right.
He was a CIA agent who had been, in the company for 30 years. Right.
And he's a family man. He had, they show his son in there.
Well, he's a struggling family man.
Yeah, but as much as you can be in that.
I guess I like that. That's what it did for me is like what I saw him when I saw Fat Clooney. I thought about like these, and obviously he was like, CIA, the I is for intelligence. He was obviously, spoke the Farsi and obviously could work all the channel, like super smart guy, intelligence guy, but those CIA agents, when we think of James Bond, right? We think Roger Moore and John.
I don't, because that's...
But, right, because you know better. But
or the Bourne Identity, that's...
Right, or
it is. But, yeah.
And so, when these scandals come out and people get kind of caught, if they're, working with the other side, or Valerie Plame or whatever, you're like, really, that guy? That guy's the guy? But, your whole job is to be that agent is to blend in with everybody else. You don't want to show up on the elevator as the buff guy. You're just gonna look weird.
And when he's on the elevator and the prince sees him, he says an American. He says no, Canadian.
Right.
He has to look like that woodsy.
You would look weird if he was bodybuilder guy. Right?
So
yeah, I thought that was an effective. I noticed it, and I thought it was a good choice.
So this time it was a good choice and effective. In Charlie Wilson's War, you thought it was completely bogus.
Why do you need Tom Hanks to be fat?
He's a senator. What do you want him to be?
All right, go on. Senators are bad.
I just had a couple of quick comments about the movie. I was generally disappointed with it, but I think that was because it is hard to follow. And you know, maybe if I watched it again or a couple more times, I would, you know, learn to appreciate some of the nuances in it. There are scenes in it that are just plain hard to watch, especially if you have kids.
Yes. Well, I didn't tell you to watch it with no.
Well, I didn't watch it with right. anybody. I'm just saying that, like, the scene with the boy in the pool.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's tough to watch for me, anyway, because the kid's the same age as my son, and it was just, oh my god. And, you know, the scene where Clooney's getting tortured, that's a little hard to watch, too. I mean, I'm not saying it wasn't realistic, and I'm not saying it wasn't appropriate for the story. It's just, you know, it's...
I think it's supposed to be hard.
It's Tarantino-style violence.
Oh, come on. That's it fine. Was important for the storyline.
Sure it was. I just put my hand
It was on. Important that they show him being tortured, but they could have been a little less graphic, I think.
I do the little creeper hands, and I put it in front of my eyes.
Oh, my gosh. But you were in the Marines, right, Jerry?
Yeah, I know.
All right.
But I do have one. All right, just to finish this up, got one more thought here. So... And again, this might just be me, but I think this is artistically carried off poorly, because the pool scene with the kid, before that, the kid's afraid to jump in the water, right? He's afraid to jump in the water, and the dad wants to go help him out, and he's like, no, it's important for his growth.
Yeah.
That, I figure that scene is it means that he's not comfortable swimming in a deep pool. That's
right.
Okay. So the fact that he did it means that, you know... He had made progress. He was growing.
Because that scene, he dives in the pool.
That's what makes it all the more tragic.
Right. And then later on, when he has to do it again, and it's night, and he's looking at that at night, and he can't see in the water that time, and it's even...
But why is he...
again.
Why does he die?
Why? What do you mean?
Why does he die? He's electrocuted.
You're asking for storyline purposes, why does he die?
No, I completely... This could be me. I completely missed that he was electrocuted. I thought
they
drowned because he was.
They show the light. You know,
they
the
showed
light
the light,
sparking.
But I thought he wasn't comfortable swimming in the pool.
No.
I know I'm wrong there.
Remember when they show the guy playing with the remote?
Right.
Everything.
And he turns the lights
just
on,
said.
and it
doesn't come on, and he's like, "Come fix this blah blah remote."
Then why have him be afraid to jump in the pool before that?
Well, it was important to the plot mainly. But
I just thought it injected some weird confusion that didn't need to be there.
No, I think
it confused. Of all the plot lines, that was not one I was confused.
Everybody in the audience is watching the kid saying, "Don't jump in the pool. You know, trust your instincts.
Right.
Don't jump in the pool."
But it's
and he did it anyway.
So beyond I think we're focusing too much on whether he wants to jump or not. Yeah, that was a little subtext there, but. You understand what happens after that. The prince
and the reason
gives
why that's there,
business
right.
to his dad.
Sure, right.
$75 million. Oh,
yeah,
how much for my other kid?
Yeah,
I'll give you $100 million for the next one. And then he says, my father is raising that estate, and we're going to build a park there.
Yep. Yeah, I understand that it wasn't just a cast-off.
And then it leads to, well, what we can only assume was divorce for him and his wife.
But they get back together at the end.
Yeah.
You didn't watch it to the end, Jerry.
I did, but
he comes home.
The thing about the credits. You just watched the credits.
Well, you don't know that they got back together. He comes back to the house where...
This is about the politics of it. What are we... talking about
To pimp my Strange Love versus your Syriana, I think there's no wasted time in the Strange Love movie. There's no...
What?
It's a tightly packed unit. Bam, bam, bam. Everything's got a purpose. I totally agree with the themes. I love the themes. I love watching it. I thought it was completely entertaining. I thought it was, you know, the images were fantastic. I mean, I can't say I didn't like the movie, but it was just sprawling in a way that wasn't compelling. Two thumbs down.
Whatever. you just don't like good movies. So. couple of last things, unless you have more thoughts on the movie. All right. Well, a couple of last things. There's one of the when the two young boys are being recruited by the terrorists. And they're at this, I guess it's an Islamic school type place slash worship.
It's either a mosque or a school. Yeah, it's not completely clear what it is.
He says, liberal society has failed, capitalism has failed, the West has failed.
Right.
But the ruling parties are benefiting from capitalism because they're making all these deals with the oil companies, so it's there's this duality there that, that doesn't add up.
Yeah, and that dialogue was...
Oh, that dialogue was terrible, Rob.
I mean, isn't that what you would... It was like a cartoon of a...
You're... All right. You know what?
No, I think I kind of see what you're saying. That I mean, it's a Hollywood writer assuming he knows what
a Islamic terrorist would say.
But, well, I think you can go on the internet and watch movies of that same thing. Maybe they didn't do that. But.
Having anti-West sentiments is certainly not out of the question.
That's pretty much central to the whole thing. Pretty sure.
All right. Go ahead.
No. Just the other piece of it, the CIA, I can't remember his name, but he's working with Bob. He's the one who coordinates the airstrike.
Right.
Yet he has a minivan. He's living in this house in the suburbs. You know, a couple of kids. I think it shows. It's trying to show something about life in America, that you're doing these horrible things, but you're just this peon guy.
Right.
Really,
at the end
you
of the
just
day,
have a house in the suburbs with a minivan, and your kid's crying because he lost his soccer game or whatever.
Right. Yeah. And then some guy from work shows up at your house, and you know,
demanding to know why he's being investigated.
Well, to me, it was the shock of having his work life interfere with his personal life, you know.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. That,
kids,
I mean, that scene.
Kids, wife,
struck
go
me.
Inside. I,
right. Yeah. I'll handle this. And then he didn't handle it. He was just like, I can't talk to you. Leave.
Yeah. Despite Rob's objections, a very good movie.
All right. We are going to dig into a little listener feedback now. We heard from our listener, AJ. He sent us some really good comments, as always. And he actually responded to our listener, Eric's comments, which is a little surreal. We've got our listeners commenting at each other now.
But we highly encourage that.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. We'd love to have them both on the show, and then they can hash it out face-to-face. So, AJ had this to say about Eric's comments. Morality in governing as a show would be great. And, yeah, as an aside, we agree, and we're actually talking about a future episode devoted to that. So he goes on to say, especially when the practice of governing that flew in the face of the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal, except not. I'm with Jerry that many of those issues were morally wrong at the time and had detractors at the time, but that view of morality wasn't agreed upon by the majority. So it's clearly not the goal, or nor should it be the goal, of laws to legislate morality, and especially laws that make morality a one-way street by carving out exceptions for the majority. So he says it's not the goal to legislate morality. So I guess I take issue with that comment. I know that's a pretty common phrase that, you know, you can't legislate morality or you shouldn't legislate morality. But so my question is a law that recognizes an act as being immoral, is that an attempt to legislate morality?
Well, that's a good question.
I mean, there are acts that are inherently immoral. If you make a law against that act, are you trying to legislate morality?
Or are you trying to legislate against some kind of injustice?
Right.
So where does it cross over from morality, immorality to injustice.
Yeah.
Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah. I mean, I'm just
fascinating.
I guess I'm just questioning, you know, the old
saying,
you can't legislate morality. Well, okay. Maybe you shouldn't attempt to, but you can, in fact, write laws that prevent people from doing immoral things. So aren't you then legislating morality?
You can write laws to make it illegal for people to do immoral things.
Now, obviously, in Jerry world,
well, I posit
it's redundant to write a law against something that's immoral.
We hold that episode on the east side.
I'm in. Okay, so other comments AJ made. Jeremy, you had something you wanted to respond to.
Wrote this idea that narcissism is somehow new smells like two things to me. Won't really get into the rest of it because that's not what I was posing, was that narcissism is new. I think it has reached epidemic levels, is what I was getting at. Narcissism, I mean, there's a character in Greek mythology about that. That's where we get the word narcissism,
right?
From Narcissus, who,
right?
You know, so, no,
saw his reflection in the water and could
so
not
beautiful.
Leave,
right?
Yeah,
so not new, but it, because of many circumstances, has reached a level unseen before and causing causing maybe a measurable or an observable, if not measurable, impact on daily life.
Yeah. I agree with you, and I think I understood what you were trying to say when you said it, that, you know, American society is preoccupied with reality TV and the internet and, and people who are celebrities simply because they're well known, you know, not for any talent or merit, just because everybody knows who they are.
Right. Yeah, I don't limit that to America. I mean,
America's perfected it. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
They have cornered the lot. I don't know.
And so, I mean, what AJ goes on to say here is the first in confirmation bias, in that we simply have more evidence in the digital age with an increased exchange of ideas that we're all essentially me monsters. And, there's some truth to that.
I think
we're all capable of narcissism.
We're all capable. We have faster and far-reaching means to do it,
right.
And we're taking away the checks and balances of it.
Right.
Good.
I come back to Facebook as an example because, Facebook, at least at one time, served the purpose of like a permanent party, right? Like where all your friends are hanging out and you're all, talking about stuff, and sometimes you're bringing up, things you've done. You're talking about yourself. And,
yeah, yeah.
And that's just become the norm now, right? I mean, that's what you do. You brag about things on Facebook. You post pictures of yourself doing cool things and make your friends jealous. Yeah.
And it's also cool to make fun of people who do that. So there's a certain... it's like this... anti-narcissism,
right.
Narcissism.
Right, it's kind of meta.
And it's not lost on me, the narcissism of this podcast. Like, I'm saying things that are so important that people need to listen to. It needs to be recorded
exactly.
And posted for people to listen to.
Yeah.
And, hey, Rob, you still here?
He's reading the feedback.
He's reading the feedback.
Right. Checking.
Anything in there you want to comment on?
I'm so happy there's feedback.
That's a lot to read. This is like a 2.5-hour documentary.
And well-written, well-written feedback, too.
These guys ought to do a podcast.
So, any stories in the reading room you want to touch on?
Of course, my favorite subject. I posted this link. top scientists start to examine fiddled global warming figures.
Fiddled.
Fiddled.
Fiddled. Yeah. Interesting. I sent some stuff home today and forgot to post it, but Australia is becoming my new favorite country / continent.
It's your Somalia, right?
I think it might be. I think it might be. More on that later.
A story that we touched on in a past podcast that came up recently. The headline was, New York judge grants legal rights to two research chimps. And then just hours later, the judge didn't agree with that press release, apparently, and put out their own statement, and that generated this headline, Judge reverses human rights status for chimpanzees.
What did we find out from the corporation that it's okay to make up news?
Yeah.
That was one of the...
Right.
So, can't take issue with that, but... another story here, woman filming law enforcement has phone smashed by federal agent, even though it's been decided in courts many times that it's okay to film,
right,
as long as you're not impeding their law enforcement activity.
All right, well, we're probably at the end or near the end. What do you think, Jeremy?
Yeah, I think we've
gone
probably off the end.
All right, so... I want to thank our listeners for tolerating our narcissism. And I want to thank AJ for all of his great comments. Thank GC for hosting us once again. And we'll see you next time.
Good night.
Bye now.